But it's a little bit like the guy whose story you have at the top of the worksheet there. This is what he says. I am 44 years old, and for most of my adult life, I have been struggling with various kinds of doubt. My reasons for discouragement as a Christian are caused less by a lack of answers than by a lack of God. I'm mostly comfortable with the historicity of the Bible, the deity of Christ, and other issues for which there are good apologetic answers. So he's saying, yeah, I believe it's true. I don't have a problem with evolution or that there's a God or that the Bible's true. I believe it's true in my head. But he says, my biggest struggle is that God doesn't seem to be there. When I pray, I never feel like I'm connecting with God. And I just don't see much in the world that gives me confidence that God really gives a rip. God seems like a character in a book who is real when I read the book, but when I close the book and look around, he's just not there. God seems about as relational and caring as the weather or gravity. Interesting subjects to study, certainly a great influence in our lives, but not quite the same as a father who calls us his children and claims to love us. Where do I go from here? I'm tired of my life being empty and pointless. I feel let down by promises of meaning, purpose, and abundant life that just fall flat. That's his kind of doubt. It's an experiential doubt. I don't feel God. I don't see God. Where is God? Different kind of doubt. Well, first of all, this is supposed to be a workshop in which there's interaction and discussion, but I kind of realized that I've got so much content here that that's the way it goes. I'll probably end up talking a lot, but feel free to have some interaction. Put up your hands and stop me. And I know everybody says you can do that and then nobody ends up doing it, but I really do mean it, that you can put your hand up and interrupt me and stop and say, I've got a question about that or that doesn't make sense. I will stop at some points for questions and I'll throw out some questions to get you guys thinking and discussing as well. But there is some stuff which I do just want to quickly move through as well. So first of all, some myths about doubt. First one is that godly people never have doubts. Godly people do doubt, even as basic a fact as whether Christianity is true or not. I remember hearing Peter Brandon confessing to that. And Peter Brandon, I don't know, many of you wouldn't have heard Peter Brandon or know Peter Brandon. He's been here several times. He's one of our sort of respected preachers on the circuit, preaching circuit, in our network of churches. Peter Brandon, I remember him confessing that there was a time in his life when he wrestled with whether Christianity was even just a figment of his imagination. Billy Graham wrestled with doubt. C.S. Lewis wrestled with doubt. Famous Christians. You look in the Bible, Abraham, the father of faith, he wrestled with doubt. It's obvious. Job, the psalmist, is constantly wrestling with doubt. I read another psalm this morning. He's doubting again. Where are you, God? Why are you missing? Of course, we all know Thomas, the famous example of the doubting Thomas. John the Baptist, such a great prophet. There he is in prison and he's wondering, why am I in prison? Where is God? He's doubting. Peter, Mark 9, you have that classic statement of a man who says, Jesus tells him, all things are possible if you believe. And he says, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. He's conscious that in the midst of his, Lord, I believe, he's also wrestling with unbelief. So myth number one is that godly people never doubt. Godly people do doubt, sometimes whether as basic a fact as whether even Christianity is true. Myth number two, doubt only afflicts Christians, but not non-Christians or atheists. C.S. Lewis has a good quote in which he says to the effect that there are times when I, as a Christian, doubt whether the whole thing is just a sham, Christianity. Then he says, but then again, there were times when I was an atheist, when I doubted whether Christianity might be true. And he says, and the times when I doubt as a Christian are less than the times when I doubted when I was an atheist. But so non-Christians and atheists, you know why you get so many aggressive fundamentalist type atheists who are so angry? Because they're wrestling with it. They're doubting. What if it is true? Okay? They're doubting as well. You bet your life they're doubting about whether atheism might be false. Doubt is relatively rare. That's a myth. Now, I don't know about you guys. I read a statistic that in one a book on doubt, which he said nearly every Christian doubts. Then again, I've met quite a few Christians who say, no, that isn't my case. I've never questioned at all. And you may be a bit like that. It might never have even occurred to you that Christianity is not even true. There are some people like that. Their experience of Jesus is so direct that the thought never comes into their mind. And so if that's you, well, praise God. You should be glad that you don't have that wrestle in your life. You'll probably have other issues you've got to wrestle with. But please have sympathy on some of the rest of us. Please don't just write us off and say, oh, you guys are all just, you know, third-rate Christians. I confess to you, I'm a person who's wrestled with Christianity many times in my life. Even as basic a question, is Christianity really true? Okay, and I suspect I'm not the only one. This year in my church, I think people struggling with doubt has been... I've had more conversations on a spiritual level with people who are struggling with doubt than any other issue. Young people, teenagers, old people, 80 years old, coming after a sermon and asking me a basic question, well, how do I know that the other religions aren't right? You know? It's rife in my church. So I guess that's what prompts me to speak here about it. I don't know what it's like in your church. It's relatively rare. I think that's a big myth. Doubt is the same as unbelief. I think there is a distinction. That's a myth. But doubt certainly can push you into unbelief. It is certainly on the road to unbelief. Doubt should never be discussed or admitted. I'd be interested to hear how many times has this subject come up in your church. Hands up if it's come up in your church in the last 5 years. Yep. That's good. I don't know. I don't remember it being talked about much growing up myself. I mean, we do talk about apologetics, giving reasons why Christianity is reasonable, and that's kind of related to the topic. But I think it's a subject which we need to just put out there on the table so that people who are struggling with doubt, got nagging questions in their mind, they're able to talk about it. Because if you don't address any issue, it just doesn't get better. It often gets worse. Doubt is always satisfied by studying the facts and the evidence. This is a big myth. Because hands up if you are into the subject, if you like the subject apologetics, which as I say is about how we can prove that there's a God, or how we can know the scientific, the evidence that Jesus really existed and that he rose from the dead. Hands up if you're interested in that sort of thing, if you find that really interesting. Okay, well, I think it's probably true that the people who are really interested in apologetics are the same people who wrestle with doubt. I don't know, maybe that's not true for you, but certainly apologetics, my passion for apologetics stems from a lot, probably in my experience, from my struggle with doubt. Well, how do I know that it is true? And apologetics does help. It does help, but it's not enough. Apologetics, it's not a matter of finding the final proof. And you know, if you just get one more piece of evidence on your side that you find out about, you can whip out to an atheist when you have a discussion with it, then your doubts will all go away. It doesn't work like that because doubt is a spiritual issue. It's not just a factual issue. Who's got the most evidence? Not just a scientific issue, it's a spiritual issue. Doubt happens mainly to those who are intellectuals. I think it's probably true that doubt does happen more to intellectuals, people who are inquisitive in their mind and like to question things. I think it's probably true that it might occur more to intellectuals than not, but it's not only intellectuals who struggle with doubt. Doubt can be resolved through the same remedy or response. There's different reasons for why people doubt, which is what we're going to talk about in a few minutes. Doubt never produces positive results. Wrong. Doubting can actually lead you closer to God. And we're going to talk about a bit about that tomorrow. If you come through your doubt. Okay, so over to you. I'm going to get you guys talking for a few moments. Talk with the people next to you and around you for about 4 minutes. What are the different problems that people have with faith in God? How do people doubt God? Make a list and try to categorize them. What are the different types of ways people doubt God or Christianity or something about their faith? It might be just listing questions, listing common questions. It might be different types of doubts, whatever you like. Just brainstorm together. Leave it there for the sake of time. First of all, why don't we have people yell out? We don't have a whiteboard, or I think we'll just yell it out. Different questions or issues that people have doubts over. Just yell it out, or how about you yell out somebody else's answer if they're too shy to yell out their own answer. If someone else had a really good thing they said, then yell it out for them. Okay, good. You mean possibly when people go through hard times and suffer? Yeah. Suffering brings that.
And just choosing
how they're going to live
their lives.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Good. What else? I'm going to choose something from every group. That'll get you talking. What about you guys up here?
Well, we said that if you're praying and you don't seem to be getting the answers, like with no contact.
Yeah? Yeah? Good? Unanswered prayer? Good? What about you guys over here?
Doubting the righteousness and goodness of God.
Okay. When would you do that?
When you're not trusting in his kingdom.
Yeah? Okay. Sometimes, again, that might be when you're suffering or when you see others suffering. And you say, how is God fair, or why is God allowing that to happen? Okay. What about you guys?
Science.
Science questions? Yeah. Yeah. They come up fairly regularly, I guess, in media. I don't know in school how much, when you do science in school, how much they push an atheistic worldview at you. Certainly in uni, you get that maybe a little bit more than what you would in school. Okay, others? Okay, two at once. Maybe over here first.
I said whether or not God is in control.
Okay, good. What were you guys? Okay, just understanding what God's like. And how God exists as a spirit and you can't see him, yeah. Okay, how about one from you guys and one from you guys? Suffering? Yeah, okay. What about you guys?
If God is perfect, why did he make us imperfect?
Okay. Yeah. All right, we'll resist the temptation to just give short, simple answers to questions like this. So that might be sort of, tricky questions, which we sort of nag at us in our mind there. Okay, any others? People way up the back. Any from you guys?
I think I had to agree with George this morning. If we didn't say it, why would we hear it?
Why would we? Yeah.
Really, is there going to be anything? Like, I understand heaven and salvation and that, but why do people suffer? It's not to do with, he already knows who's going to be saved.
Yeah.
Why does choice persist?
Yeah. Okay, so that's, again, that's sort of a meaninglessness question, or what's my life about sort of thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe that it's hard to sometimes be confident about God's goodness when he gave us the choice to sin. So that's challenging.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the problem of evil, I guess, and why did God allow evil to come into our world? Okay. What about categories. Did anybody get into this? What are the different categories of ways we doubt God? Some of that might overlap with what you've already said, but can anybody suggest different categories of way we doubt God? Yeah, that's more of an issue. Intellectual questions. You know, some questions are just tricky questions, you know, and almost like, can you answer this? You know, this is a tricky question, but you can't answer this. So it's more of an intellectual question. Relational, experiential, that's to do with our feelings and why don't I feel? Anything else on that? Because that's where I'm going, so that's good. So you're kind of coming up with where I'm going to go. So let's move on. A lot of what I'm saying today in this session comes from a guy called Gary Habermas, who's very good friends actually with Mike Lacona and had a very similar pathway, grew up in a Christian home, went through massive periods of doubt, went and studied the resurrection, became convinced because of his study of the resurrection that Jesus is really the Son of God. And anyway, ended up writing these two books, The Thomas Factor and Dealing with Doubt. You can read them both for free on the internet. The entire books are on the internet at his website, GaryHabermas.com. And he wrote another book, which isn't on his website, but which is quite good as well, called Why Is God Ignoring Me? And that's very helpful too. So a lot of what I'm saying today is just plagiarism from this guy. But it's good. And this will make you go and read him for more details, hopefully. So what he says is key to dealing with our doubts, very helpful in dealing with our doubts, is understanding what type of doubts we're wrestling with. And he says there's three types of doubts. There's factual doubts. And what is that basically coming from? It's coming from an ignorance. We don't know what the answer is to this question. And so I doubt because, well, I don't know. But then it moves a level deeper and it becomes emotional doubt. And often, at this level, it's fear. It's fear of what other people think. It's fear of man rather than fear of God. That is at the root of many types of emotional doubt. And then the third level becomes volitional doubt, where it becomes, it's not that I just don't know the answer. And it's not just that I'm struggling with my feelings. It's I don't want to believe. And I decide not to believe. And that is pure unbelief of the worst type. So let's think for a few moments about what are these different types of doubts. Factual doubts. Well, that might be someone asks you a really tricky question about the Bible. Or what about this contradiction? This passage seems to say this, this passage seems to say that. Contradiction. There, the Bible's wrong. You don't know how to answer that contradiction and say, oh, well, I don't have a clue. I don't have a clue. I don't have a clue about some guy on television says that the Exodus never happened as it talks about in the book of Exodus. I don't know how to answer that. It's a factual doubt. This happens a lot with people who might have a questioning intellect. Inquisitive, always asking questions, always, you know, how do you prove that? How do you know that? How do you know that? Sort of people with that sort of way of thinking, they often might have factual doubt. Factual doubt, though, what Gary Habermas says is that emotional doubt is by far the most common type of doubt. And the basic thrust of a lot of his book is that recognize your doubt for what it is. It's an emotional doubt, which shouldn't be shifting your faith in Jesus. And so there's lots of different types of emotional doubt. And Gary Habermas has counseled hundreds of people on who doubt, and he kept records on every single one of them. And it's through his records of his counseling with hundreds of people who doubt that he makes these categories and he starts to realize what's going on. So many people are wrestling with emotional doubt. For example, he says one type is the what-if questions. What if I didn't pray my prayer of salvation properly? My first experience of doubt was when, as a young Christian, I doubted whether I was really saved or not. A lot of people have that sort of doubt. Hands up if you have had doubt that you were really saved since becoming a Christian. Okay. Very common. A lot of people say, well, what if I didn't pray it right? What if? There's always some smart aleck in RE who comes up with this amazingly, outrageously clever theory for how there was this guy who sort of pretended to be four different writers of the four different gospels and made up this amazing hoax. It says, what if? And it's just a what if. Incredibly improbable, fantastically improbable. You can always ask a what if. Some people say, what if I've committed the unpardonable sin? You can ask a what if about anything, though. What if I get AIDS if I go outside of my house today? What if you get pulled over by the police to have a random breath test? And you say, what if I fail the test? Hang on a minute, you haven't drunk for ever. You're not going to fail that test. But, you know, sometimes these irrational fears come into our mind. And we need to name them for what they are and say, well, I've got no good reason for saying what if. We need to challenge the crazy what-ifs with show me your reason. Sometimes it's just our psychological states. We're feeling depressed. We're feeling anxious. We're feeling burnt out. We're feeling irritated. We come to church Sunday morning and the church service isn't the greatest church service you've been to. And so the thought comes in your head, oh, this church is just a load of nonsense. What prompted you to think that? Well, might it have anything to do with the fact that you're depressed at work? That you had an argument with your wife on the way in the car? Could that possibly be related? I think it certainly could be possibly related. There is often something behind the doubts which prompts it. Sometimes it can be just how you're feeling on the day. Might be a change in feelings. I don't feel the same way I used to when I first became a Christian. When I first became a Christian, I was full of joy and I could see God answering all these prayers. But now that seems to have gone all quiet and it's all dead. Well, that's just the way you're feeling. Feelings isn't a good reason for changing your faith. It doesn't change any facts, the fact that your feelings have changed. Could even come down to medical issues, physical problems. Some people have manic depression. Some people are suffering from lack of sleep, a poor diet. If you're living foolishly, your health, your general health is suffering. Well, when it comes to thinking about God, it might not be a surprise if you have angry thoughts towards God, if you're living foolishly, just in the way you're living your life. Might be difficult life events that you've been through, childhood problems, which you haven't really got over. And so you're dealing with some issues in your life. It doesn't change any facts about whether there is a God or whether Jesus rose from the dead or not. Those are difficult issues, yes, but it doesn't change the fact, any facts. But these sorts of things can make us question. Imagination and romanticism, sometimes we might be, you know, we go into a movie or we watch a novel and we get caught up in the drama of it all, and maybe the church is portrayed very negatively. Or maybe sort of your Anne of Green Gables, Jane Austen type world in which everybody is just charmingly lovely people and everybody has some sort of general vague faith in God but not a real relationship with God. And it's just a, you know, this imaginary delightful world. And we think, oh, well, why do people need salvation? But that's an imaginary world. That's not the real world. Now, these ones start becoming even more powerful, subtle, should I say. Peer pressure. Pressure to be more moderate in your views. You know, you work with a whole lot of non-Christian people. You go to a school where most people are non-Christians and they say, oh, you're really religious, aren't you? You go to church every Sunday. Boy, that's pretty full on, isn't it? And just that subtle pressure. You should be more normal. You should be more moderate. Nothing about facts, about whether there is a God, about whether Jesus rose from the dead. It's just a subtle pressure. Just tone it down a bit, your faith. Don't be so out there. Well, that's just emotion. The challenge of pluralism. A question many people struggle with. And it's a good question. It's a question which we can't help struggling with. Why are there so many people who don't know Jesus? Why are there so many other religions? It's a good question. But ultimately, it is a question about peer pressure. It's saying, I care what other people believe. But it doesn't matter how many other people believe something else. That doesn't change what is the truth. There was a day when everybody believed that the earth went around the sun. And Galileo had to stand up and say, no, that's wrong. And he was the only one saying it. Now, he could have said, but everybody else can't be wrong. Why are so many other people wrong? It doesn't matter how many people believe something else. That doesn't change what is the facts. So it's a reasonable question to ask, which you can't help asking. If you're driving down the road and everybody is coming up your lane and you're going down the wrong way, well, you soon start to think, maybe I've made a mistake, and the 100 people who are driving up and nearly crashing with me, maybe they're not wrong, maybe it's me that's wrong. It's a reasonable question to ask why there are different people who believe different things. But in itself, the fact that there's different, that people have different beliefs from you, and that there's lots of people who have different beliefs from you, it doesn't change any facts. It doesn't change what truth is. Anxiety over unanswered doctrinal questions and controversies. Why are there so many different points of view amongst Christians? I can't understand the doctrine of election. Why should I pray if God already knows what he's going to do? Some of these doctrinal questions, which there seems to be lots of argument amongst Christians, and we say, well, there's so many different types of Christians who all disagree with each other. Well, maybe the whole thing's wrong. But that doesn't follow. Yes, there are differences of opinions, and there are difficult questions of faith on minor doctrinal issues. But you come back to the core of that fact, whether does God exist and whether Jesus rose from the dead. Well, those are two basic issues, which those facts don't change, whether depending on our views of election or depending on our views about what hell's like, makes no difference at all to whether Christianity in its core is true or not. Finally, Christian hypocrisy or apostasy. And this one is one which I've wrestled with a lot. Sometimes, to be honest, I look at people in my church or in other churches, and I just don't see much in them that makes me think that the Holy Spirit is doing very much. And yes, then I look at my own life and I see that the Holy Spirit's not doing very much in my life either. And so I say, well, is it real or is it not? Well, it's not a wrong question necessarily, but it doesn't change whether God exists and whether Jesus rose from the dead. It's an emotional question. Even worse, maybe, when when someone we know who seemed to be a Christian now no longer follows Jesus. That influences our emotions and makes us wrestle with, well, what's going on there? But again, it doesn't change any facts. So, C.S. Lewis, I've got a few quotes here, which is all to do about with this emotional doubt, which is the most common type of doubt. C.S. Lewis says this: our faith in Christ wavers not so much when real arguments come against it as when it looks improbable. When the whole world takes on that desolate look, which really tells us much more about the state of our passions and even our digestion than about reality. Everyone must have experienced days in which we're caught up in a great wave of confidence or down in a trough of anxiety, though there are no new grounds either for the one or the other. Of course, once the mood is on us, we find reason soon enough. We say that we've been thinking it over. But it's pretty plain that the mood has created the reasons and not vice versa. When once our passion takes part in the game, the human reason, unassisted by grace, has about as much chance of retaining its hold on truths gained as a snowflake has of retaining its consistency in the mouth of a blast furnace. The sort of arguments against Christianity which our reason can be persuaded to accept at the moment of yielding to temptation are often preposterous. Reason may win truths, without faith she will retain them just so long as Satan pleases. So that's emotional doubt. You see what he's saying? Often it's not real reason. It's just how we're feeling on a day or what someone else does which affects us, or wanting to be not be too out of line with the great majority of other people who believe something different. Third type of faith, doubt, is volitional doubt, which becomes pure unbelief, in which it's a failure to obey God's word. And what may well happen is if we just continue to let continual this type of emotional doubt fester in our mind and we don't deal with it, it'll grow and become volitional doubt, in which we don't do about it, or then we disobey God. And let me tell you, once you've disobeyed God in a fairly significant way, it's very hard to then make a big turnaround and say, no, I'm going to come back to God. It is possible, yes. But let's say you sleep with a boyfriend who sort of tempts you into this relationship and you say, I know it's wrong, but hey, I can always go back to Jesus if this relationship doesn't work out. And then you get pregnant and your life's a mess. It's not easy for you then to turn around and say, yeah, I did do wrong and I want to come back to where I was before. You see, you've been practicing unbelief, and your heart gets harder and harder the more you and the more you disobey. And it's far easier to follow the way your heart has been hardened against God. So volitional unbelief says no to God and says, I don't want to believe. And it continues down that road. So, why believe? Why should we believe? Is it just a matter of emotion? I mean, basically what I'm saying to you so far, with a lot of our doubts just comes from our emotions. So what I'm saying is you need to get your emotions, you need to pull them into line, you need to tell them to behave. And you need to say, you don't belong in my mind because I'm a Christian. But of course someone might say, well, that's just sort of playing mind games. Why should you believe anyway? Why should we believe? Okay, well, this is a little acrostic I've come up with. I shared it at another camp, this acrostic. Some of you might remember it. Are you for real? Why do you believe? Some people believe because of F, because of their feelings. Because when I come to church, I feel God. I felt God in my life. And so I know Christianity is true because I feel it. Some people believe in Christianity because of their reason. Because I've gone and I've researched Jesus' resurrection and it really did happen. And I know all the scientific arguments that there must be a God. I've worked it out in my mind. Yes, there is a God. My reason tells me I believe. Some people, it's E. I've experienced God in my life. I've seen God answer prayers. I've seen lives transformed overnight. I've seen a miracle. I've experienced God. I can't deny that. It's a miracle. Some people, A. Well, I haven't had much of an experience with God myself, but there's another person who I know, and I respect him so much. My Sunday school teacher, an elder in my church, an older brother, and they've got something which I really want, and I just follow them in their footsteps. Or it might be purely the fact, I believe God. I don't know who I can believe. I don't know who I can trust. I bow to God's authority. Because if I can trust anybody, surely it's God. Or finally, L, loyalty. Well, I believe, I don't think many people would confess this, but a lot of people believe because, well, it's what my family believes. It's what my culture believes. All my friends, my youth group. Why are there so many Muslims and why are there so many Hindus and why are there so many Buddhists? You get a few people who sit down and think about. You get a few Muslims who sit down and think about Islam and think about Buddhism, but the great majority follow their religion, because to betray their religion is to betray their culture and to betray their family and to betray their nation. That's why. It's loyalty. See, my brothers taught me from an early age that if I wanted to be a member of the Wilson household, I had to support St. George Illawarra, the football team. It was just a condition. We support St. George. They're the best team. I never questioned it. I didn't go and look at the statistics of how many games they'd won. It didn't matter. It was just loyalty. That's where you live. That's who you support. And that's how it is with religion. Many people, many people, they just believe because that's what my mum and dad want me to believe. And that's what all my friends, my church social, whoever, that's who I hang out with. That's where my loyalty lies. Why should you believe? Talk about it for a few moments. F-R-E-A or L? Or maybe you want a few of them. Why should you believe? Talk about it. Let's hear from a few people. What did you come up with? Were there any ones that you thought were poor reasons for believing?
Loyalty.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's fair enough, maybe, that kids growing up in a Christian home, you can't really expect much more of them, that they believe there is some degree of loyalty in their faith from an early age. That's just natural, that, you know, they're not going to think for themselves, they're just going to follow in the footsteps of their parents. But I would say that you get to a certain age, and if your faith hasn't grown than more than just loyalty, then your faith is not going to be very real. If it's just borrowed off your parents, just believing because this is what my parents want me to believe, this is what my grandparent wants me to, this is what I've been told just that I have to believe. If it isn't for yourself, then I think your faith isn't going to go very far. It's either going to be dead, it's just going to be nominal, turning up to church, saying the right things, looking the right way, but having no reality, or you'll probably drift away and give up your Christianity sooner or later. It needs to be more than loyalty, I would think.
It needs to be more than any loyalty.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, I think there are faults with all of them. Not one of them is going to sort of be everything that you need.
But I don't think any one of them is incorrect either.
Yeah.
Even feelings is valid.
Yeah. 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 Well, I'd say that's fair enough. Yeah. Good. Yeah. What are the weaknesses of some of the others? What's?
I think feelings is can be a dangerous one at times as well. Because, for example, let's think about a husband and wife. You might have an argument. You've got brassed off with the other person, but that doesn't mean you don't love them anymore.
Yeah.
And so to base the relationship on the feelings can be dangerous.
Yeah, definitely. There's quite a bit of overlap between feelings and experience. But you ask a Mormon, how do you know that Mormonism's true? Their standard answer: I asked God to show me if it's true, and I felt a peace in my heart. Okay, they're basing everything on their feelings and on their experience. Problem is, the Book of Mormon's a mess in terms of history. Serious issues. Reason, big fail. Feelings. People in all different religions have religious feelings. Feelings isn't a reliable guide just in itself. If you had a religion without feelings, well, or, you know, and nobody ever felt God, well, that would be strange. It's a fascinating fact I've come across recently that they've done surveys, people who study religion, not Christian people, they study religion as a phenomenon, and they have found, they started doing surveys about 1960s. Back then, they found to their astonishment that 30% of Western society claimed that they had an experience with God. 30%, one in three, had a personal experience with God. They kept on doing the surveys. Latest in 2000, it's up to 70%, 75%. Claim they have some kind of experience with God. God is not as far away as we think. Okay? I think they can be genuine experiences with God. It's just that they don't know who God is and they haven't come to a real relationship with God. But God is touching people in different ways. Anyway, that's beside the point. Reason. What's the problem with reason? You don't know everything. There's always an opposing argument. We want proof. But God hasn't given us proof. God has given us good evidence. He's given us good reason. That's why Gary Habermas and Mike Lacona, they do all this research on the resurrection of Jesus, and they say, yep, the evidence is rock solid, but it's not proof. Because God wants us at some point to make a moral decision for of our own, rather than just this is a mathematical proof which everybody has to just blindly follow. It's got to be a step of choice as well. So experience, we've talked about authority and loyalty. Authority, of course, the big problem with trusting a human authority is, well, what if they're wrong? Obvious. But on the other hand, authority is good because I don't know everything. I don't know what Mike Lacona knows and what Gary Habermas knows about the resurrection of Jesus. I've got to trust a fair bit of what they say. I'm not an expert on the resurrection of Jesus. I'm not an expert on the science of whether God exists. I've got to trust somebody. So in my personal journey, I sort of lean on the three in the middle. Reason, as far as I can see, my reason points me to Jesus as far as I can see. Experience, I haven't had huge amounts of experiences that would make thrilling reading in a Christian biography. I've had a few interesting experiences in my life, but I look at the other experiences of other Christians and I just cannot discount the experiences which other people, many people claim to have had of God doing remarkable things in their life. And then authority, and the authority which I refer to is the authority of God. Because once I believe that there must be a God, I must trust somebody. Who am I going to trust? Am I going to trust my parents? Am I going to trust my brother? Am I going to trust some scholar? Well, at the end of the day, I'm going to trust the one who made the world. If there's one person I can trust, it must be my Creator. And so I reach out in faith to God, the Creator, and say, God, I put my trust in you, and my reason and experience are pointing to Jesus. And so therefore, that's the foundation of faith. That's how it works with me. So this is putting that together in a different way. This is how it works for me. This is how I explain my faith to others, why I'm a Christian. I've got basically, it's like a three-legged stool. First leg of the stool is creation. Creation shows that God is necessary. Now, we could spend a whole session on, you know, doing apologetics and stuff on each of these 3 points, but we won't take the time today. I mean, here's some of the standard arguments, but I mean, it's pretty intuitive. Why do most people believe there's a God? 70% of our society or so still believe that there's a God. Why? A lot of them, they just look at creation, and it doesn't matter even if they believe in evolution. They still believe there must have been a God who started evolution if they believe in evolution, because they just can't get their heads around the idea that it's all just happened by chance. Most people can look at creation and just see a bird flying across the sky and say, whoa, this just isn't an accident. Or a butterfly or a little baby. And you look at the science of it and you find out about DNA. And to me, it is so self-evident. It's only the hardness of people's hearts, really, which allows people to argue seriously that there is no God from creation. So my first leg of my stool is creation shows that God is necessary. Experience shows that the spiritual realm is real. There's more than just matter. When you see God at work, things like, some people, they just have a self-evident knowledge of God in which God is as real to them as their own senses are. And, you know, people don't question whether their senses are giving them the right information. People just assume that it is. It's just self-evident. And some people have that type of assurance of God as well, that God is just a self-evident reality. There's other things. A lot of people have visionary experiences of Jesus. Muslims become Christians often these days in different countries because they see Jesus. And then they hear about, then they go and sometimes in the dream they're directed to go and talk to somebody, and they go and talk to somebody, that person's a Christian who shows them the Bible. Near-death experiences, people have incredible experiences after they die, and it shows that there's a spiritual realm. It shows that there's more than just physical flesh and blood. So there's our experience, which shows that there's more than just the physical, there's a spiritual realm. And thirdly, Jesus shows that Christianity is true. And of course, by that, we're talking about the evidence, the historical type of evidence for Jesus, such as The cornerstone of it is the resurrection of Jesus. But, I mean, we don't have time to go into this, but it's fascinating that here are six facts which are agreed by the great majority of historians. Whether you are a Christian or whether you are not a Christian, nearly all historians will agree that this is the truth about who this person Jesus was. He proclaimed himself as God's special messenger. He was known as a miracle worker. He died by crucifixion. His tomb was found empty the following Sunday. His disciples experienced multiple appearances of Jesus. Paul and James were converted to faith after these appearances, and the Christian church sprang into life due to belief in the resurrection. Now, whether you're a Christian or not a Christian, historians accept those six facts. They're what is true about Jesus. Now, if you're not a Christian, for example, number E, his disciples experienced multiple appearances of Jesus, they'll say, oh, they had some kind of weird vision. But you put all those six facts together, and what's the best explanation? The fact that it really happened, that Jesus rose from the dead, and that the people who first wrote about it were right. They weren't just making it up. So we've got these three, for me, these three foundations of Christianity. Now, Michael Kona and Gary Habermas, they sort of lean almost exclusively on the resurrection of Jesus, and that's fine. I guess for me, these other two just sort of add further weight to the resurrection itself. If you don't take the doctrine of creation, if you don't have creation and experience, then a lot of atheists will just say, oh, well, we don't know what happened to Jesus' body, but he couldn't have risen from the dead. But when you've got creation, that there must be a God. Creation shows that God is necessary. And when you've got experience, that there must be a spiritual realm, then all of a sudden, the resurrection of Jesus, it just doesn't become a mystery. There's a clear reason what has happened. He's been risen from the dead, just as it becomes very, very possible, very, very probable in view of those facts. So these are, for me, the three legs, the three foundations, which I come back to again and again and again. Having established that, what's the implication of that? Well, if Christianity is true, and by that I mean the core facts of Christianity, which is two core facts. There is a God, and Jesus is his representative, his son, his messenger, his Messiah. Those three foundations prove those two facts. So therefore, Christianity is true. Doesn't answer all of my questions about Christianity, but I just know at a basic level that the core of Christianity must be true. So if Christianity is true, well, what do I make of this book called the Bible? Well, if Jesus really rose from the dead, this book says it's the Word of God. Well, there's a very strong probability then it is the Word of God, because it's really true that Jesus rose from the dead and this is his book. So this is true. That follows. A lot of people, they do it the other way around. And they say, how do you know Jesus rose from the dead? And they say, because the Bible tells me so. I believe the Bible. And the Bible tells me that Jesus rose from the dead, so therefore, Jesus rose from the dead. How do you know that the Bible's true? Well, that's a big subject to have to defend. As I turn it around and go the other way. How do I know that the Bible's true? Because I know that Christianity is true. I know that Jesus rose from the dead. And so Christianity at its core is true. How do I know that? Because of those three legs. Creation, experience, historical evidence about the resurrection of Jesus. So therefore, if Christianity is true, what does that do for the Bible? Well, it says that, yes, the Bible's true if Jesus really rose from the dead. So from there I go with the Bible. And then thirdly, then I come up against these hard challenges, hard questions, like, well, what about the contradiction between this passage and that passage? Isn't that a contradiction? What about the doctrine of hell? I mean, can you really believe in the doctrine of hell? I mean, isn't that unfair or just very hard to accept? What about the age of the earth and what the Bible says about the age of the earth? What about the doctrine of election? What about suffering? Why are there so many people suffering? Now, with these types of issues, by all means, we can use our reason and we can try and present the logical answers to these questions. And there are some, you know, good logical answers to many of these questions. But at the end of the day, even if I don't know the answer to why is there suffering, if at the end of the day, even if I have questions which even nag my mind about hell or about some problem which I can't understand about a verse in the Bible, I can live with those questions because I can say, I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know that Christianity is true and I'm willing to trust God on some of the hard issues which I don't fully understand yet. So, any questions that you guys, I've done a fair bit of talking there. So, you got any questions you want to raise about that?
Just a comment. I actually appreciated what you said before about rather than asking the question how to know the Bible is true, you looked at the evidence and the proof that Jesus did rise from the dead, and therefore that then proves that the Bible is true.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's how I come to the Bible being true. Rather than when you come to a non-Christian or an atheist and they say, well, how do you know the Bible's true? And then you've got to defend almost all 66 books. You've got a lot to defend, a lot of facts to defend. And, you know, they can say, oh, but what about that verse? And you explain that verse and they say, what about that verse? You leave that second. You establish Christianity is true. And all you need for that is God exists and Jesus is his son. And we get that by the resurrection, that it really happened in history, our experience, creation. We establish Christianity is true. And then as a result, as an implication of that, well, the Bible must be true. It's God's inspired word. I can trust it in its entirety, even if I don't know the answers to all the questions. It happened a long time ago. It might be issues which we've just lost, which would help us understand if we knew it. We are only human. God is big. He's above us. It's no surprise that we don't understand everything. So I can, by all means, try to answer these questions which people ask about these different issues, try and think about it, wrestle with it. But at the end of the day, if I can't work out the answer, I can live with trust in God on the unanswered questions, but still have a firm faith, go back to my foundation, that I know that Christianity is true. This question, it's a good question. I wrestle with it a bit, but I'm willing to trust God on that one. But I do know that Christianity is true. Let me tell you an experience I had a few months ago. I went to a wedding of the son of a good mate of mine. He really loves the Lord. Sat down at a table, and I noticed that there was a friend of his, a converted Muslim, who was sitting two seats away from me. And then there were two family members on either side of me. And I thought, what's the chances that my good friend has placed me next to one of the family members who I've heard about? The brother-in-law. Grew up in a brethren home. Went to church, conservative brethren upbringing. Went to Bible college. Studied, went to become a missionary overseas, went to Bible college and did a master's degree, which is the same kind of degree I'm doing, completed his master's degree, continued work overseas, returned home from overseas to say that he was no longer a Christian, he was an atheist, and now he was promoting atheism. He had given up, and he decided it wasn't true. I said, thanks, mate. A whole evening next to this guy who he knew as much as I knew about the Bible and about apologetics and about all the questions. And there he placed me, sort of hoping that one of us would get him. Either the converted Muslim who'd had a vision of Jesus and been converted through this vision, or me, a Bible college guy who could sort of try and get him with the apologetics. Well, it was a great night. I kind of had a hunch that it would be him, and I didn't go looking for arguments. And he didn't go looking for arguments for me either. But we kind of got talking, and Ruth came and sat down and asked the question, so what church do you go to anyway? knowing that our friends had a brethren upbringing, and so tried to work out the history there, and said, well, so what sort of church do you go to now? Well, actually, I don't go to church anymore. We just don't think it's for us. We don't believe in it. We just couldn't really take it. We were missionaries, but we came home and gave it up. Had a good discussion. What were his issues? Well, he struggled with hell. He struggled that so many, I think it was Hindu or Buddhist people that he was talking to, how he could just tell them all that they were going to hell. And clearly he was struggling with being burnt by a few Christians. And he complained about the Christian churches who he was dealing with overseas and how they struggled, you know, they were worse living than some of the other people. And how he'd been mistreated by Christians at home. And he, you know, threw up a few different of these types of issues up the top there, doctrinal issues. And I sympathised with him a lot. I didn't try to argue with him a lot. I sympathised. I said, yeah, I feel that way about hell often too. You know, I struggle. You know, I don't have a logical problem with hell. I can see the logic of hell. But emotionally, yeah, I struggle with the idea that as far as I know, lots of people may be going to hell. And I sympathise with that. But then what I did with him was I shared, look, I can see where you're coming from. I'm a bit of a doubter myself. I've struggled with doubt. But for me, Christianity is true. Because these are the three things which I keep coming back to, which I can't get away from. And, you know, I welcome you to prove one of my three foundations wrong. Because if there's a fault, I want to know about it. But this is why I'm a Christian. You tell me what you think of it. I went through and I said, look, I just can't get away from the fact that creation shows that there must be a God. You know, and he tried to talk about evolution and something. And I said, come on. But, and I went and just said, but this doesn't, I just really can't get around it. And on some of those arguments there, the fine-tuning one is one of my favourites that's listed there. And you know, no atheist has a good explanation for the fine-tuning argument, and I've listened to lots of atheists try to explain it, and they just simply don't have a good explanation for it. And to me, I told him, look, the fine-tuning one on its own, it convinces me that there must be a God. And then I talked about experience, and I said, the second one is experience, and look, God does stuff, I just can't deny it. Are you saying that all those people are just lying? What do you do with it? And I told him a story or two, and he said, that didn't really happen. And he just denied it, pretended it didn't happen. But yeah, for me, I just can't do that. I just can't go there, because that's a bigger step of blind faith, to just deny the fact that God is alive and does things in people's lives. And I didn't get much chance to talk about the third one, about the resurrection of Jesus, but I just said, look, I think the best explanation of the historical facts about Jesus, that it really must have happened. He really must have risen from the dead. So at the end of the day, I said, look, yeah, questions there which some of them I struggle with too. I don't have the full answer, but at the end of the day, I'm compelled to be a Christian because these three things just push me in that direction. He wasn't converted, but at the end of the night, I was encouraged. I walked away from that evening, had a great night. Because even though my faith was tried up against, you know, up against the most, probably the most, the hardest opponent, if you like, I honestly felt that my faith was as sure as it's ever been. I had no reason to doubt whatsoever. Because although there were questions which I didn't maybe have the full answer to, there were a basic foundation which gave me assurance. So that's how it is for me. We're out of time, and maybe we can spend a bit more time on the other things tomorrow, but essentially the rest of it down the bottom, how do we deal with doubt then? You notice that the guy's doubts, they were emotional doubts. He'd been hurt by people, and he struggled with the idea that some people would have to go to hell. They were emotional doubts. So basically, bottom line at the end, you've got to pull your doubts into line. You pull your emotions into line. Recognise the normality of your doubts, and after a while you start seeing them for what they are, and you start, sort of like if you've got a recurring illness, you get the symptoms coming on, you know, after a while you start to know what it is and what to do about it. Isn't that the case when you've got some sort of sickness? Same with doubts. You start getting the questions. After a while you start recognizing what they are. And while they're still early in their place, you just put them in their place in your mind. Don't let them dominate. Apply skepticism towards your doubts. Ask yourself, well, am I just having a bad day? Am I just ticked off with some other Christian in church? And that's why I'm feeling angry about being here at church today. Am I just depressed? Am I overworked? Is this just an emotional doubt, or does it have some basis in fact? Remind yourself of your faith foundation. Go back to the foundation. Is Christianity true? That's how I know it's true. That's where I've come from. So therefore, I'm going to trust God, maybe on the questions that I don't have the full answer on. 4, discipline your minds to think God's thoughts. You see that a lot in Philippians 4. We won't read that passage, but we don't have time to do it now. And so another quote here by Lewis. Faith, in the sense of which I'm here using the word, is the art of holding on to things your reason has once accepted, in spite of your changing moods. Faith is holding on to what your reason has accepted in spite of your changing moods. Oz Guinness says, the long-term solution to doubt is training faith so that it is not overwhelmed by moods and emotions. Unless we do this, our emotions will lead us around by the nose and we'll be captives to every passing impulse or reaction. But once faith is trained to control the emotions and knows how to lean resolutely against weaknesses of character, another entryway of doubt is blocked and sealed shut forever. Finally, I've put in another one which isn't in your notes because it's a very biblical one. You get it constantly throughout the Psalms. Remind yourself of God's action in history and in your own life. It's amazing how we forget what God has done in our life, and we only remember the times where God has been silent. That's what sticks in our mind. So remind yourself, rehearse the story, tell others about what God has done in your life. Keep that fresh. That's part of disciplining your mind. And finally, live out your faith and practice. And that's what we're going to talk about more. Tomorrow and the next day will be significantly different in what we talk about. It's more growing our faith and seeing our faith come alive. But part of our faith, seeing our faith come alive, is getting out there and living the Christian life and enjoying God and experiencing God. That's a great antidote to doubt, isn't it? Obedience and living it out. So, hope that's been helpful. There's a few notes on Philippians 4. That's a great passage to read. It's really talking about emotion, how to handle our emotions, but it's great to apply it to doubt, as we've seen, emotionalism is one of the problems of doubt. So, let's pray, and then if you've got any other questions, you can hang around and talk more.